Many have forgotten the struggles past, which brought us to this moment in world history. The United States, once a beacon of hope and a temple of liberty, now goes abroad in search of monsters, in the process destroying both hope and liberty, while neglecting those at home who need her the most. How did it come to this, you ask? Where is that beacon which anew could light the world? It is with those questions firmly in mind that we ask you to view what follows here, such that the United States might finally become what it was originally intended to be. People came from across the oceans to see for themselves the realization of the promise given by the implicitly universal Declaration of Independence 100 years prior, of a world where all men are created equal. The Philadelphia Centennial then, like its echo in the Belt and Road forums today, inspired nations from all over the world to a future yet unimagined until that point in time. 9 million visitors, including scientists, engineers, industrialists, and economists, saw a vast array of drill presses, saws, printers, water pumps, and much more, located in more than 200 different buildings, and all powered by one single steam engine. Baldwin Locomotive Works constructed several exceptionally beautiful locomotives just for the centennial, and the 29-year-old Thomas Alva Edison put on display his automatic printing and multiplex telegraph devices. Never before in history had such a powerful vision been exhibited. One of the attendees, the German machine builder Franz Rouleau, wrote home describing the sight that had met him.
These numerous separate exhibitions, many of which are of vast dimensions, produce, together with the great exhibition halls, an impression much like the movements of a mighty fugue, in that every voice intones anew the main movement, each, however, with its own character, entwining and interweaving itself with the other figures, until, finally, the entire tremendous industry orchestra, roaring and thundering, comes together to bring the theme to the conclusion. Never before has this overall impression been so perfectly achieved. In any case, the effect betrays a master's hand at the conductor's baton.
This conductor was the American economist Henry C. Carey, whose writing stood centrally in the exhibition, promoting what was known then as the American system of economics. Where the British system had been unable to develop the vast territories and resources over which it presided for centuries, the American system had managed to turn a relative wilderness into the greatest economy of the world. Contrary to the British theory of ground rent, which argues that the value of property, like agricultural lands, mineral resources, and even slaves, is fixed and provided for by nature alone, the American experience had demonstrated that the best agricultural lands were the fruits of the cumulative developmental input by farmers in the form of irrigation, fertilizers, and more. When machinery and tools, combined with denser energy sources, replaced the physical labor, one person could now achieve that of 100. It is therefore the level of science and technology, not so-called natural resources, that determines the relative level of a society's productivity, which in turn relies on the relative cultural and educational development of each individual in that society. The human mind's ability to innovate and discover, and not some predetermined values in nature, is the only true value of the economy, and this, therefore, is what must be fostered above all else. It was for this reason that the German statesman Gottfried Leibniz, the original founder of this branch of economics, concerned himself with making that process of discovery, or what he called ars inveniendi, intelligible. This creative potential becomes, at the same time, the sense of self-worth which the individual places upon him or herself. This is the philosophical basis for the American system. The national banking policy of the United States reflected this same outlook. The American system used tariffs to protect its infant industries from the dumping of cheap British slave labor goods, which would have otherwise destroyed the new nation in its cradle, and took sovereign control over national credit under a dirigist national bank. The purpose of this was to ensure a flow of low-interest credit for high rates of technological progress and the building of infrastructure, known as internal improvements, with the resulting increase in productivity being the underlying security for the credit issued. The federal government would regulate the private banking system towards these ends, encourage innovations, and take responsibility for educating the public. The British system of Adam Smith, against which the American Revolution was fought, asserts that there is no morality in economics, merely a Darwinian struggle of each against all. No concern for the development of the creative powers of the population, only keeping the herd happy, following each person's sensual gratifications, while the invisible hand, located in the City of London banking houses, steals all it can from the enslaved colonies, and even from the pockets of its own subjects. Anyone who happens to perish in this process simply wasn't meant to be. It has been so decreed by Adam Smith's and Charles Darwin's God, also known as the British East India Company.
The administration of the great system of the universe, the care of the universal happiness of all rational and sensible beings, is the business of God and not of man. To man is allotted a much humbler department, but one much more suitable to the weakness of his powers and to the narrowness of his comprehension.
From the time of the settlers at Boston, the conflict between these two diametrically opposed outlooks has always been the fundamental fight inside the institutions of the United States. After the demounting of the national banking institutions, beginning with the Andrew Jackson presidency, the Lincoln presidency, built around the Whig forces of Henry Clay, Matthew Carey, and the German-American economist Friedrich List, finally began to reestablish the American system, while the Civil War, the British-instigated slave owners' rebellion, raged on. Even with the British-sponsored murder of Abraham Lincoln, who had saved the Union using American system methods to overpower the slave-driven Confederacy industrially, these policies did not cease, and in 1876 led to the Centennial Exhibition, organized by the same forces now led by the son of Matthew Carey, Henry C. Carey.
Two systems are before the world. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. The other to increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action, and civilization. One looks toward universal war, the other to universal peace. One is the English system. The other, we may be proud to call the American system, for it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world. Such is the true mission of the people of these United States.
Using this system, the United States developed into a mighty industrial powerhouse. The population continually grew, the living standards increased, and the continent was united by a series of canals and rail lines, with the transcontinental rail connection being completed in 1869, tying the country together from east to west. Under Henry Carey's leadership, these patriots, far from promoting an isolationist nationalism, promoted a world community of sovereign nation-states against the system of empire. Much to the dismay of the British imperialists, the American system was spreading internationally from Germany and France to Russia, China, and Japan. In Germany, Chancellor Bismarck, having studied Carey's and Liszt's writings, broke with the free trade system and adopted the American system of economics.
The success of the United States in material development is the most illustrious of modern times. The American nation, not only having successfully borne and suppressed the most gigantic and expensive war of all history, but having immediately afterward disbanded its army, found employment for all its soldiers and marines, paid off most of its debt, given labor to all the unemployed of Europe as fast as they could arrive within its territory, and still by a system of taxation so indirect as not to be perceived, much less felt. Because it is my deliberate judgment that the prosperity of America is mainly due to its system of protective laws, I urge that Germany has now reached that point where it is necessary to imitate the great tariff system of the United States.
This echo of Friedrich Liszt's earlier establishment of the customs union was the basis for the expanded industrial and infrastructural development which was to follow. In France, high tariffs were introduced, and the French rail network expanded. In secret agreement, French and German industrialists planned a rail connection from Berlin to Baghdad, with the help of the head of Deutsche Bank, Georg von Siemens, in order to create entirely new trade routes throughout the world, independent of the British-controlled sea trade. In Russia, American railroad engineers worked with Russian Transportation Minister Count Sergei Vita, the economist and chemist Dmitry Mendeleev, and others to organize a system of higher tariffs and the construction of the Trans-Siberian Rail Project, modeled on Lincoln's American Transcontinental Railroad. The ultimate intention was to link the European railways with the Anglo-Indian railways through Central Asia, as well as by furthering the Baghdad Railway and linking with future Chinese railways. The very first locomotive on this Trans-Siberian was built in Philadelphia by the Baldwin Company, and by 1890, the Russians were planning a Bering Strait bridge to connect to America. In Japan, during the Meiji Restoration of 1868, revolutionaries under Prince Tomomi Iwakura overthrew the feudal Tokugawa warlords. They set up a modern central government guided by Japanese students of Henry Carey and Friedrich Liszt. In 1871, Carey's student and political agent, E. Paschein Smith, was appointed economic advisor to the Meiji Emperor. Other Carey associates were also then in Japan, working with the new government, identifying mineral resources, planning transport, and outlining protectionist tariff strategies to develop Japan as a modern industrial power and counterweight to British genocidal policies. Japan became a leading American ally and created the first independent national bank in that region of the world. In China, Count Witte, together with French Foreign Minister Aneteau, set up the Russo-Chinese Bank, largely with French capital, which was allowed to lease the necessary territory for building the last leg of the Trans-Siberian Line through Manchuria, creating a new company, the Chinese Eastern Railroad, for that purpose. Where the British had unloaded crates of opium, American Civil War engineers unloaded crates of Baldwin locomotives. Carey ally Wharton Barker, an outspoken proponent of the dismemberment of the British Empire, worked with the circles around the Chinese emperor for the creation of a joint Chinese-American bank. And his China modernization project included a system of Chinese-run national railways and telegraphs. This was the American system's 19th-century world land bridge, a win-win policy between sovereign nations, illustrated by the Burlingame and reciprocity treaties with China and Hawaii, where instead of British cheap goods, drugs, and slave labor, these reciprocity treaties were negotiated to organize a community of principle, whereby nations could trade on the basis of bolstering the economies of each other. That is, working to strengthen each other, to modernize the world and eliminate poverty and conflict once and for all.
Such is the true mission of the people of these United States. Do unto others as ye would that others should do unto you.
But with this perspective on the horizon, the British Empire's very existence was now under mortal threat. The dominance of the British Empire relied on a relationship between control of the world's sea routes and enforced underdevelopment of interior land masses. The acquisition of strategic naval ports, or choke points, marked here in red, was the pivot of the system. By controlling these ports and corresponding sea lanes, the British dominated trade, using colonies such as India or African nations as sources of cheap raw materials and slave labor. Other nations wishing to engage in the same geographical area would have to operate through the British. The transcontinental rail projects of the post-Civil War period, therefore, emphasizing interior development of land masses, such as America's transcontinental, Russia's trans-Siberian, and Germany's Berlin-Baghdad systems, were a mortal threat to the historic maritime-based power of the empire. The only thing which could prevent the American-initiated new economic world order was for the British Empire to manipulate and pit the group of collaborating nations into conflicts with one another in a great world war. And in Shakespearean Iago-like fashion, this exactly is what the Empire proceeded to do. Factionalizing Japan's leadership against the American system, the British convinced some of its leaders that Japan, an island power like Britain, with industrial strength but few natural resources, must build an empire to supply those resources. And instead of being an American system stronghold in Asia, the country was turned into a British-style imperial power. Britain convinced the German Kaiser to fire Bismarck, opening the way for pitting Germany against its former European allies. An American system president, William McKinley, who had supported the extending of rail networks to the southern cone of South America, was assassinated by London-protected anarchists, leaving the presidency to the Anglophile Teddy Roosevelt. The optimistic dynamic for common development was broken, and the nations who had previously worked together were manipulated into horrendous wars, each against all, with only the British House of War as winner. But now, much to the chagrin of these same circles of empire, still centered in the imperial city of London, this dynamic has been reawakened, re-emerging in a powerful echo of the past in China's New Silk Road Initiative. Sun Yat-sen, a lifelong student of the American system of economics and the founder of modern China, wrote shortly after the First World War,
"The recent world war has proved to mankind that war is ruinous to both the conqueror and the conquered, and worse for the aggressor. What is true in military warfare is more so in trade warfare. I propose to end the trade war by cooperation and mutual help in the development of China. This will root out probably the greatest cause of future wars. The world has been greatly benefited by the development of America as an industrial and commercial nation. So a developed China, with her 400 million of population, will be another new world in the economic sense."
Although the global dynamic around the American system was only revived later, under the banner of the New Silk Road, as promoted by Lyndon and Helga LaRouche, Sun Yat-sen, with the help, among others, from Henry Carey's former Chinese collaborators, laid the groundwork for China's infrastructural development that was to come. He believed that only if China were to develop its land, water, education, and transportation systems such that people could settle wherever they desired, allowing them to exploit their creative and productive potential in any part of the country, could China become a great economic and cultural power. It is for this reason that Dr. Sun Yat-sen, in his detailed program for the development of China, emphasized the necessity for building major sea and river ports, extensive railroads and waterways through interlinking and making hundreds of China's rivers navigable. To realize his vision, he discarded the British free trade philosophy of Darwinian competition of each against all, and instead adopted the approach of the American system.
"It has been discovered by post-Darwinian philosophers that the primary force of human evolution is cooperation, and not struggle, like in the animal world. If we still retain the custom of free competition, or laissez-faire, it would be like encouraging a crippled man to compete with an automobile in a race."
Unfortunately, this vision would have to wait, as China was plunged into world war, civil war, and the so-called Cultural Revolution, which suppressed and even killed the scientists and intelligentsia of China, echoing former legalist emperor Qin Shi Huang, who had burned the Confucian classics and even buried alive Confucian scholars themselves. Only after the defeat of the Cultural Revolution, with Deng Xiaoping taking over the helm, was Sun's vision for China, at least implicitly, put back on the agenda. Opposed to the Gang of Four, who had led the Cultural Revolution, Deng prioritized the development of a science and technology cadre above all else, placing the creative potential of the individual in the center of an economics policy, in an echo of the self-same principle at the foundation of the American system of economics. Believing that this strategy would cause China to emerge as one of the world's leading nations within 30 years, he sent thousands of students to study in the U.S., Russia, the U.K., Australia, Germany, and other nations to master the most advanced learning in all fields. So, although China, in its weakened position following the Cultural Revolution, acceded to becoming a low-wage producer as a prerequisite to enter the international system, its long-term strategy was that of forging the means by which it could work its way out of those conditions. They allowed foreign firms to use the cheap labor, but would maintain tariffs, currency controls, and bank separation, and did not give up their state-run banks and industries while allowing the private sector to flourish. Prioritizing areas like nuclear energy, computer technology, semiconductors, astronautics, and lasers, they intended to leapfrog to that higher stage of development in which we see them emerge today, often as leaders in their field internationally. Firmly rejecting the British central banking models, like the U.S. Federal Reserve System, the country took itself along a path of non-linear changes, including dramatic decisions in developing its state-directed dirigist financial system. Or, to borrow from the terminology of President Xi Jinping, the visible hand would guide the invisible hand. Let us briefly review the most crucial decisions. In 1993, as some financial institutions had begun to misuse the interbank lending rate for speculative purposes, the decision was made to separate commercial banks from their affiliated trust and investment firms. At the time, a number of Chinese specialists report that these measures were modeled on the U.S. Glass-Steagall Law implemented 1933 under American System President Franklin Roosevelt. Commercial lending was separated from the PBC and moved into four specialized banks with the idea of providing directed credits more widely and effectively. Based on the total amount of assets, the Big Four, as they are now commonly called, are the biggest commercial banks on the planet. A year later, under the leadership of the State Council, China then created three new policy banks, the equivalent of national banks. These three state-owned policy banks, each with special areas of investment, are the Agricultural Development Bank of China, the China Development Bank, Export-Import Bank of China. This dirigist banking system would serve as the vehicle for financing the massive expansion of infrastructure and production, which were to follow.
So therefore, the Eurasian land bridge conception, an idea which was initially presented in the 1860s by Henry C. Carey, the economist who was also a partner of President Abraham Lincoln.
Intersecting these developments in the 90s were the efforts of Lyndon LaRouche and his international organization. Following the death of Franklin Roosevelt, and especially the assassination of JFK, the LaRouche organization was the only potent political force still representing the American system of Carey and List in the United States, which had increasingly been taken over by British free trade ideology. Beginning with his forecast in the 60s of the coming collapse of the Bretton Woods system, LaRouche time and again demonstrated the incompetence of the British system and defined clear alternatives in line with the American system tradition. His proposal for an international development bank, his Oasis plan for Southwest Asia, his program for the Indian Pacific Ocean Basin, and comprehensive plans for the development of the African and South American continents. LaRouche's ability to forecast strategic shifts and to expose various British intelligence operations, combined with the growing support for his policies, within governments worldwide, as well as within the institutions and among the citizenry of the United States, soon earned him the wrath of the British financial oligarchy. With the help of their lackeys in the U.S. establishment, they succeeded in throwing LaRouche and many leading members of his U.S. organization into prison. In October 1988, right before his unlawful incarceration, he went to Berlin and forecast the coming unification of Germany and the disintegration of the Soviet Union.
Many today will agree that the time has come for early steps toward the reunification of Germany, with the obvious prospect that Berlin might resume its role as the nation's capital. For the United States, as for Germans and Europe generally, the question is, will this reunification process be brought about by assimilating the Federal Republic into the East Bloc's economy or economic range of influence, or can it be accomplished in a different way? In other words, is a united Germany to come into being as a part of Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, as President de Gaulle proposed, or, as Mr. Gorbachev has desired, a Europe from the Urals to the Atlantic? I see the possibility that the process of unification could occur precisely as de Gaulle proposed. The economy of the Soviet bloc itself is a terrible and worsening failure. In Western European culture, we have demonstrated that the successes of nations of big industries depends upon the technologically progressive independent farmer and what is called here in Germany the Mittelstand. Soviet culture in its present form is not capable of applying this lesson. Despite all attempts at structural reform, and despite any amount of credit supplied by the foolish West, the Soviet bloc economy as a whole has reached the critical point. At its present time, in its present form, it will continue to slide downhill from here on, even if the present worldwide food crisis had not come into being.
As the Berlin Wall came down, and his forecast was borne out, LaRouche, from his prison cell, worked with his wife Helga Zepp LaRouche, heading up a group of scientists for a program which would have saved the industrial capacities of East Germany and the other states of the Comecon. Obsolete only from the standpoint of the world market, these capacities were still valuable in themselves and could have been modernized with the help of Western technologies. This program, called the Productive Triangle, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, would transform an area approximately the size of Japan, which contained the world's greatest concentration of productive industrial capacity at the time. With the proposed injections of high-level technologies, it could have become the locomotive, not only for Eurasia, but for the world economy as a whole. Following the official dissolution of the Soviet Union the following year, the LaRouches expanded the concept of the productive triangle into the Eurasian land bridge. The idea was to extend development corridors along the Trans-Siberian Railroad and the lines of the ancient Silk Road, stretching all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific coast. This proposal would economically integrate the entire Eurasian continent, maximizing the productive potential of its territory and peoples for the common benefit of all, and resolving the artificially imposed strategic divisions among the great powers through the promotion of development in their mutual interest. Had this program for the Eurasian land bridge, or the New Silk Road, as they called it, been realized, it would have been the perfect basis for a peace plan for the 21st century. Although great interest was shown among many industrialists as well as others in different countries, this perspective for ending geopolitics through a new paradigm of cooperation did not sit well with those forces who wanted to build a unipolar world and turn Russia into a raw materials producing third world country. All the countries of the Eurasian continent were contacted with a proposal to conduct a conference on the Eurasian land bridge, But only in China did the concept receive a positive response, resonating not only with the new attention on Eurasian development, since the link-up of China's rail system to the former Soviet system in June 1992, but with the tradition of the American system as developed by Carey, Liszt, and Sun Yat-sen. Due mainly to geopolitical maneuvers by the British government and their influence in the EU, it would, however, take a few more years before finally, in 1996, a major conference was held in Beijing under the title The Development of the Regions Along the Eurasian Landbridge. The conference was jointly organized by the Chinese government and the EU, and chaired by Chinese State Councillor Song Jian, with, all in all, 34 nations participating. Helga Zeppler-Rusch gave one of the major speeches titled Building the Silk Road Landbridge, the Basis for the Mutual Security Interests of Asia and Europe, in which she presented the vision of the Eurasian Landbridge as the engine for the world economy. We propose, therefore, a totally different path. The governments of Eurasia should agree on an integrated infrastructure program, which connects the industrial centers of Europe and Asia with the population centers in South and Southeast Asia through development corridors. The development of those main axes of traffic through great projects for infrastructure in transport, energy, water, and communications is the precondition to lay the groundwork for the industrial development for the Eurasian landmass and can thus become the motor for overcoming the world economic crisis. She also called for the founding of a new Eurasian Development Bank to fund these projects, as well as the building of thousands of new cities with capacities from 300,000 to 1 million people, of which many should be science cities for fundamental research and teaching. At that 1996 conference, the Chinese government announced the realization of the Eurasian Landbridge to be the strategic, long-term perspective of China through the year 2010, a perspective which was interrupted by the outbreak of the Asia crisis in 1997. In January of that same year, the LaRouche movement published a special report, The Eurasian Landbridge, The New Silk Road, with its in-depth discussion of development corridors and of the national banking approach needed to finance the project, the report circulated far and wide. In the following years, Helga Zeppler-Rusch returned to China many times, participating in conferences and seminars on the Eurasian Landbridge. Through her role in promoting the concept of a new Silk Road internationally, she became known in China as the Silk Road Lady. Over the following years, the LaRouche movement organized hundreds of conferences on this subject across five continents. Although the realization of the Silk Road project would be slowed down both by the 1998 Asia crisis, created by George Soros and other hedge fund speculators, in part to disrupt the economic integration of Southeast Asia, as well as the crash of the dot-com bubble, the internal development of China continued at full steam ahead. The year of 98 was also the year that the government declared that it would construct a modern, comprehensive transportation system utilizing different transportation modes in a coordinated way. The result was the most advanced intermodal transport system ever devised. The bulk of the financing came from one of China's three policy banks, the China Development Bank, which specializes in infrastructure financing. This has been key to China's high-speed rail development. In 1993, commercial train service in China averaged only about 30 miles per hour. As of early 2018, China had constructed 13,670 miles of domestic high-speed rail track, double that of the rest of the world combined. In the United States today, not a single kilometer of rail would be counted as high speed by China's standard, that is to say, 155 miles per hour. New high-speed rail is presently coming online in China at the rate of 1,240 miles per year and is projected to reach 23,600 miles by the year 2025. The speed record reached in commercial rail traffic so far is just above 300 miles per hour, and with magnetic levitation systems already in place in Shanghai and under construction elsewhere, the potential for going way beyond that is already being laid. To make a comparison with the United States, the trip between Xi'an and Luoyang, which is slightly more than the distance between New York and Washington, D.C., takes about 1.5 hours and costs the equivalent of $18. To touch but briefly upon a few further points, the life expectancy has risen from 43.7 years in 1960 to 76.7 years in 2018, an increase of 75%. Based on the World Bank's International Poverty Line standard of $1.90 per day, China has lifted more than 850 million people out of poverty since 1981. And the annual energy consumption per capita, known to be an essential indicator for the living standard of the population, has risen from 152 kilowatt-hours per capita in 1971 to 3,927 kilowatt-hours per capita in 2014, and has continued to rise. All told, an increase of more than 2,500%. These are the effects of what is known historically as the American system, now with Chinese characteristics. The issue here is not the American system's Americanness, but the fact that it is based on a universal principle, whose validity has been demonstrated both by the previous American and now the Chinese experience. Reflecting the difference between the American and British systems, the Chinese leadership is clearly aware that real profit is different from the purely financial and lies instead in the unshakable commitment to building up the productive economy through scientific and technological progress and to uplift the Chinese people, to further the people's livelihood. As Sun Yat-sen had put it, his formulation of the General Welfare Clause in the preamble of the U.S. Constitution.
Innovation is the soul driving a nation's progress and an inexhaustible source of a country's prosperity. This is what Confucius meant when he said, "If you can in one day renovate yourself, do so from day to day." Yes, let there be daily renovation. Life never favors those who follow the beaten track and are satisfied with the status quo. The top priority of the financial sector is to support the development of the real economy.
In contrast to these developments in China, the British system came to systematically replace the American system in the United States itself, beginning with Nixon's takedown of the fixed exchange rates of the Bretton Woods system in 1971, to be followed by the deregulation of the 1980s and the destruction of Glass-Steagall in the 1990s. The search for short-term monetary profit, driving globalization in search of cheap labor and derivative speculation, replaced long-term productive investments into the real economy, and the here-and-now so-called green anti-growth identity, fueled by legalization of drugs and a culture of ugliness, replaced the sense of being a productive contributor towards the well-being of the generations coming after. The crash of 2008 was the consequence of that long-term paradigm shift. If it were true that a culture's character is best seen in their response to a crisis, the difference between the reaction of the West and that of China to the world financial crisis of 2008 is quite telling. as the Western central banks and governments, caught in British free trade ideology, refused to recognize their own catastrophic assumptions and poured $15 trillion onto the financial fire of forever worthless financial paper, China invested the equivalent of $10 trillion into infrastructure, science, and productive capacities. The government recognized that China could no longer maintain its dependency upon cheap exports to the European and U.S. markets, and instead, it had to create new markets, and in the process, uplift the rest of the world. China would take leadership in moving the world away from a global, unipolar British system of speculation and looting, replacing it instead, in the words of Xi Jinping, by a world community of common destiny, an international alliance for common economic development, pivoted on the building of modern infrastructure in all parts of the world. The announcement, in 2013, of the Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road, on the drawing board since the 1990s, was an implicit clarion call for shifting the world dynamic back towards the perspective represented by the American system of the 19th century. The LaRouche movement subsequently published several special reports as part of a campaign to encourage all nations, including the US and Europe, to join and to educate policymakers and citizens about the progress of the BRI, including the underlying economic principles involved. In modern clothing, this perspective is based on the concept of the development corridor. Like the role of the bloodstream, which distributes nutrients, oxygen, and more to the rest of the body, the rail lines do not simply connect from A to B, but are intended to become the economic bloodstream, connecting the hearts and minds, the industries and population centers, around which the tissues of modern economies can develop. Six main corridors extend out from China in all directions, including a corridor across the Bering Strait, the shortest distance between China and the United States. They extend across Central Asia and Southwest Asia, as well as Russia to Europe. And its maritime Silk Road extends across the oceans to the Americas and to Africa. In South America, like Lincoln's Transcontinental Railway earlier, plans for rail lines moving from Peru to Brazil are already underway. In Africa, China and the African Union are planning to build an integral rail system for the entire continent. In water management, China is partnering with Ethiopia to build the Renaissance Dam project, which will not only improve the management of water resources, but will also increase that country's electricity production by as much as 50%. Italian and Chinese companies are working out the details for the greatest water project in human history, called the Trans-Aqua Project. It will divert a small percentage of the Congo River's water to refill Lake Chad, which has been drying out, and in the process create vast amounts of electricity and an important internal transportation corridor. Combine this project with the various underground aquifers, which have been found underneath the Sahara, and it opens up the potential for the greening of the vast desert.
The Sahara would bloom for hundreds of miles. It is true wealth. The Sahara is not just sand. It has an amazingly rich potential. Imperialists don't realize what wealth is, what wealth they can create. They rob these continents of billions, and all because they were too short-sighted to understand that their billions were pennies compared to the possibilities.
just like China is literally ripping up the old British Empire tracks in Angola, replacing them with new modern standard gauge tracks, the BRI seeks to rip up the old geopolitical order at its roots and replace it with a new world order based on universal security and common development for all.
The Chinese people are deeply aware that peace is essential to humanity, just like air and sunshine. Without air and sunshine, things cannot survive and grow. Don't do unto others what you don't want others to do unto you. China needs peace, loves peace, is also willing to do its utmost in preserving world peace, and to sincerely help people haunted by war and poverty. We cannot have the security of just one or a few countries while leaving the rest insecure. In no way can we accept the so-called absolute security of one at the expense of the security of others.
As did the centennial celebration in the 19th century, the Belt and Road Forum celebrate the possibility for each country to repeat the economic success story of China for themselves. Representatives from more than 100 nations, including 36 heads of state and around 5,000 delegates, attended the most recent forum. A large number of government cooperation agreements were signed and concrete development projects agreed upon. Just like the United States then created the opportunity for each nation to develop its own economy in imitation of the American experience, so the nations of today are given the chance to learn from China's experience and join in this new world community of common destiny, leaving behind the modern British Empire's sinking ship of speculative finance and confrontation. Those still caught in the ideologies of imperial geopolitics and Huntingtonian clash of civilizations will project their own psychological mindset onto China and scream about hidden conspiracies for secret world domination. But they will increasingly be exposed for the hypocrites they really are.
Some take a dark view of China. They even portray China as being the terrifying Mephisto who will someday suck the soul of the world. Such absurdity couldn't be more ridiculous. Yet some people, regrettably, never tire of preaching it. This shows that prejudice is indeed hard to overcome. A review of human history shows that what keeps people apart are not mountains, rivers, nor oceans, but lack of mutual understanding. As Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz once observed, only the sharing of our talents will light the lamp of wisdom.
The real United States, not the clueless strongman manipulated by British geopoliticians, always sought this dialogue with all cultures. Now, China has taken up the leadership of this paradigm of thinking. 19th century America sought to turn the work of one man into that of 100, or even that of 1,000. And with its 50 to 60 million people then, it threatened the very existence of the British Empire. Today, the global financial empire, still centered in the old, rotten city of London, is utterly bankrupt, weakened way past recovery. And China, with its 1.4 billion people, utilizing the same economic principles as the United States did earlier, has already built alliances with more than half of humanity. If the United States were now to join with the greatest nation-building project in world history, the imperial London-centered system would not only be overpowered, but would disintegrate overnight, and a creative transformation not even imaginable for most people today would suddenly grip this entire planet in a more far-reaching and rapid economic expansion than ever seen before in history. That potential is within our grasp. But if the United States were to reject this chance, not only would it miss the opportunity to make a vital contribution to forever freeing mankind from the oligarchical grip, it would be rejecting its own historical identity, the very intention upon which it was founded. Let us therefore decide not to let this chance pass us by. Let us at last realize the true intention, which lies at the foundation of these United States.
Therefore, if the United States, so the President of the United States and China, participate in fostering that project, sometimes called the Silk Road Project, sometimes the Land Bridge Project, if that project of developing development corridors across Eurasia, into Africa, into North America, is extended, that project is enough work to put this whole planet into an economic revival. So that what we have here is a set of projects which are not just transportation projects like the Transcontinental Railroads of the United States, which was the precedent for this idea back in the late 1860s and 1870s. But you have development corridors where you develop on an area of 50 to 70 kilometers either side of your rail link, your pipeline, so forth. You develop this area with industry, with mining, with all these kinds of things, which is the way you pay for a transportation link. Because of all the rich economic activity, every few kilometers of distance along this link, there's something going on, some economic activity. People working, people building things, people doing things. To transform this planet in great projects of infrastructure building, which will give you the great industries, the new agriculture, and the other things we desperately need. There is no need for anybody on this planet who's able to work to be out of work. That's simple. And that project is the means. Then what do you have? You have the United States and China and a bunch of other countries ganged up together against the greatest power on this planet, which is the British Empire, called the British Commonwealth. That's the enemy. And if on one bright day, say a Sunday morning after a weekend meeting, the President of the United States, the President of China, and a few other people say, we have determined this weekend, based on our advisors and the facts, that the international financial and monetary system is hopelessly bankrupt. And we, in our responsibility as heads of state, must put these bankrupt institutions into bankruptcy reorganization in the public interest. And it is in our interest to cooperate as nations in doing this, to avoid creating chaos on this planet. The result then is that such an announcement on a bright Sunday morning will certainly spin the talking heads on Washington TV. But otherwise, it means that the entire system is of that moment has been put through the guillotine and the head is rolling down the street. Alan Greenspan's head, perhaps. That means we have at that point the impetus for building immediately a new financial and monetary system. Now, in putting a corporation which is bankrupt into viable form, what do? You've got to find the business that it's going to do, which is the basis for creating the new credit to get that firm going again. The Land Bridge program, with its implications on a global scale, is the great project which spins off directly and indirectly enough business, so to speak, for every part of this world to get this world back on a sound basis again.
Thank you.